This is The Illusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, read all the books about how to get language to love me back. I'd not planned this, but today's episode is the third in an unintended but welcome mini-series about emotions. We had the episodes about cowardice and anxiety, and then sentimentality and empathy. And today, it's self-help. Content note, we discuss dieting for a bit, and there are fleeting mentions of rape and abuse. There are also category A and B swears. I'm really sorry to the person who left a very nice review of this show, but did say there's too much swearing for their taste. I'm not trying to test you, I promise. Sorry. Before we get to the self-help, I just wanted to tell you that I'm in a couple of live events coming up soon. My brother's podcast, The Bugle, has just reached its 15th anniversary and is doing a live tour to celebrate, and I'm in one of those shows on the 27th of October 2022 in Birmingham, and then doing a bit in Robin Ince's Nine Lessons and Carols for Curious People on the 16th of December 2022 in London. Links are at theillusionist.org/events. On with the show. I have absolutely no recollection of how or why I obtained this book, but I found on my bookshelves a dark green volume printed in 1876 of the new edition of Self-Help by Samuel Smiles, author of The Lives of the Engineers. The book was first published in 1859. My updated edition has added Perseverance, and it is, as far as we know, the first ever self-proclaimed self-help book. It was a huge success. Darwin's On the Origin of Species was published the same year, Self-Help outsold it in its first year, and went on to sell a quarter of a million copies by the time of the author's death in 1904. According to the British Library, in the mid-1980s, Margaret Thatcher's government wanted to give a copy to every schoolchild in Britain, although that's not how I, a British child of the 1980s, ended up with one. Not surprised they loved it, though, as one of the themes is how you can't rely on government to help you, so you have to self-educate and pull yourself up. The spirit of self-help is the root of all genuine growth in the individual, writes Smiles. Help from without is often enfeebling in its effects, but help from within invariably invigorates. Though I don't think modern writers would use words such as enfeebling, Smiles' message is very similar to a lot of self-help literature now, and it's a multi-billion dollar genre of books. And wherever language is used to convince us to do things, I am there sniffing at it. This time with two self-made experts in the self-help genre.
I am Jolenta Greenberg. I'm a comedian and a bit of a pop culture commentator. And I host the podcast By the Book, where myself and my dear friend Kristen, we live by self-help books 2 weeks at a time to see whether or not the advice actually works. And we live by them pretty strictly.
And I am Kristen Meinzer. I am a culture critic. I also host By the Book. And Jolent and I have also had a couple of spinoff shows, including Romance Road Test, where we live by questionable relationship hacks. We also wrote a book called How to Be Fine, What We Learned from Living by 50 Self-Help Books. We wrote that book a few years ago. At this point, we have now lived by over 80 self-help books. Self-help is the philosophy, the idea that we can improve ourselves, whether it's our romantic lives, our work lives, our relationship with ourselves, our sense of confidence, our ability to make money, any of those things, by researching and applying that research to ourselves. Usually that research is through self-help books. Sometimes it is through meditation, through mantras, through different practices that are done for the most part alone rather than with a professional, without the help of a therapist, without a professional coach or whatnot. So self-help, it's improvement of ourselves by ourselves.
Because no one else will do it?
Apparently.
Well, I think there are a few reasons behind it. I think one is that especially in the United States, there is this history of self-determinism. Whether or not it's really true, that's questionable. But this idea that you can, you know, arrive on the shores of the U.S. as a pauper, and after a generation or two, you can have a grandchild who is a captain of industry, or you yourself can become a captain of industry. You can be anything you want here. And, you know, a lot of that's not true, but the mythology of self-determination is one reason I think that self-help is so huge in the U.S. And this idea that I really am not just born into a caste. I'm not just born into a class and have to stay there forever, even though a lot of us actually are in the US.
Yeah, do you think these books work in terms of upward mobility?
Well, they really want you to think that.
I am interested to learn that the term self-help first appears in the early 1800s in a legal context, but then it is 1840s where it is about kind of what it means now. But it's people like Ralph Waldo Emerson writing about self-help and other eminent white dudes.
Right. Benjamin Franklin, I believe.
Yep. He wrote a self-help book. Yep.
The term self-help wasn't even in use yet when Benjamin Franklin was writing his memoir of his life up to 1757. This is now held up as one of the early landmarks in the genre of self-help literature, containing steps for self-improvement that have inspired writers of self-help to this day. And Benjamin Franklin is a golden example of the self-made man for other men who want to make themselves. And the aforementioned self-help by Samuel Smiles is definitely aimed at men too, full of inspiring gentlemen like Sir Francis Drake and Dr. David Livingstone and Lord Wellington. It's not all inspiring British gentlemen either. Napoleon Bonaparte is given as an example of a first-rate man of business. But nowadays, self-help is marketed far more at women than men.
Well, there's an interesting stat. Goodreads did a study that found that two-thirds of self-help authors are men and two-thirds of readers are women. So it really is an industry of men telling women what to do. And just knowing that stat, I think, can help readers to maybe take what they're reading with a grain of salt and keep in mind what the dynamics are.
And what the end goal is.
Yeah.
Go to seminars and buy their other book.
And keep it tight.
And lose some weight.
Yeah, yeah. Why not?
And keep them from examining those systems that harm them.
Right, right. The things that actually make them feel bad.
A certain thing's going to be not called self-help because they're like, men aren't going to buy that.
Oh, totally. Lots of books about how to optimize yourself or better yourself in terms of your work life are touted as like business books or like money books because, you know, if you're a bro in business, you don't want like better self-esteem or to believe in yourself. You just like want that raise. So I think a lot of books about like how to get on in work or how to get ahead in work are just self-help books that are labeled business. And I think those are the ones that are predominantly for, according to marketers, for male consumption, where I think the term self-help now is skews much more towards implying a female readership.
Yeah, even though the books are frequently covering exactly the same ground.
Yeah.
Is it because men's personalities are already fully optimized?
Of course.
Absolutely. Men, they are perfect and already completely self-actualized, totally optimized. No, but I do think that there has almost always been more of an expectation on men to tough it out. Don't seek help. Don't go to a therapist. For God's sakes, don't read a book that has the term self-help on the cover anywhere. Don't do that.
Internalize those feelings.
Yeah. Don't be emotional. And self-help, just the terminology itself can sound kind of emotional and touchy-feely to some people.
It's funny that the term is both quite maligned in that way, but also at the same time quite edified by the culture of like anyone could be anything.
Right, right.
Oh, yeah. And then also that whole DIY element, you know? We love the idea of, you know, I built it with my own hands. At least in the US, we love that whole idea of like, I'm a self-made millionaire. I didn't inherit my money. So there's that DIY element to it as well.
Something we come across so, so often in self-help are these authors saying, look, if I did it, you can do it. Just be like me. Just wake up early and do these five steps or just focus on these three things and like swap them out every day or whatever the formula is. And then you know, barely peek into that author's background and they're Mark Zuckerberg's sister or they grew up wealthy with generational wealth, went to Harvard Business School and now are writing a book. And these are all people who are essentially born, you know, on third base as opposed to someone who may have been born on first or second, and to just, without any regard to circumstances or the systems that are larger than individuals, to just say, like, be like me, when without examining what me is or how privileged me is such, it's just depressing and a little damaging. And it also it instills that doubt of, like, why am I not Mark Zuckerberg's sister? Or why was I not born into a family that all went to Harvard so I could go to and then just write a book?
Well, if you thought about that before being born.
If only I had the foresight.
Foolish embryo.
Silly me.
Yeah, and some of the advice we just can't apply if we don't have some of those same privileges. Like, we have read so many books that just say meditate for an hour or two a day. In one case, an author meditates for more than 2 hours a day. And how many people can do that while also working their jobs and taking care of their children and doing everything else that needs to be done? Taking out 2 to 4 hours a day just to meditate is not going to work for everybody.
Or the amount of books that tell us, just hire a personal assistant, hire a housekeeper. That's pretty niche advice.
Yes.
And it's not very actionable, and it just reeks of privilege.
I guess there is a certain extent to which, or certain circumstances in which, a positive attitude can help you in life more than a negative one, but it's not necessarily taking into account all that many factors contributing to the same situation.
Yeah.
Right, I mean, right.
A positive attitude can only do so much when you're dealing with structural racism, you know? A positive attitude can only do so much when you're dealing with classism or any other kind of ism. It can be a nice way to go about your day, and I tend to be happier when I don't wake up each day and think, oh, everybody is out to get me. And instead, if I wake up and think, oh, I wonder if I'll have any interesting conversations today. That's a nicer way to go throughout the day, but it's not going to take care of things like misogyny.
Maybe you weren't trying it hard enough, and that's why we still have misogyny. Kristen, manifest it harder. Oh.
I clearly wasn't. And that's why there's a wage gap.
If you didn't manifest it, you didn't believe hard enough somewhere.
Can the books make you worse?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, totally. Oh, yeah.
Kristen has a lot of experience in that, more than I do, I feel like.
I do.
I give up quicker, I think, is the issue.
Oh, not saying, oh, Kristen was so nice when we began the show.
Pretty much.
I was, and I'm not anymore. No, a lot of the books blame the reader. You know, it is time for you to take responsibility for everything you did wrong to get yourself in this position where you're picking up this book in the first place. Let's talk about accountability and what you did to put yourself here. A lot of books kind of have that mindset. It is time that you take ownership over things. Circumstances can't be changed, only your reaction to them. Why are you being so overly emotional about this thing? What did you do to ask your dad to hit you? There are actually books that say things like this. What did you do to lead him on, that man who did that thing to you?
That's a neat cocktail of victim blaming and also ignoring the fact that people don't start with the same situation and resources.
Right.
Yes.
Thanks, books.
Right. One of the main things a lot of these books like to do is, like, remind you how bad you are at the beginning. Just like a pickup artist. Like, there will be a chapter or two sort of nagging you or being like, you know you're lazy about this. You have to. A lot of books make you admit, some even write down all the areas, like, you're failing in or not putting 100% into. And so you literally will have, like, a list sometimes of reasons why you suck. And then they're like, and now I have the answers. And it's like, but you made me, like, make up these problems in the first place. So they like to kind of dig you in a hole and then be like, I can dig you out too.
That's a classic technique, like Listerine inventing halitosis.
Yeah.
Yes.
To sell product.
Yes.
A lot of the books we come across point out perceived personality deficit or flaw and harp on it, give you some general wishy-washy advice, but it's always advice that leaves you, like, with a bit of self-doubt or a bit wanting more, usually so you'll buy their next book or go to that seminar or maybe buy their, like, journal that you should fill out too. So just reading it can often make you start doubting things you didn't doubt before. in order to sort of entrap you into becoming an audience member that returns to whichever author is writing.
It's a fairly obvious tactic for a book to bring you down so that it can bring you up, or like you're not going to buy a cure if you don't feel like you have the ailment. But do you find there are some books which are trying to embrace you a bit more and be like, you're okay as you are, but here's some additional stuff to enrich you as a human? Or do they not play that way?
Oh yeah, some books do that. Be a little kinder to yourself and don't constantly treat yourself like the enemy. There are definitely books like that. Like, you don't have to necessarily treat your thought processes like they're the wrong one. And there are definitely books that are saying, embrace your uniqueness. Not a lot of them, yeah. But they do exist.
There's a book called What to Say When You Talk to Yourself by a real doctor, Dr. Shad Helmstetter. And he talks about sort of how our brains make the pathways that they do and how we get sort of stuck in thinking patterns and ways to adjust that so we aren't always talking down to ourselves or classifying ourselves in negative ways. We love when books acknowledge, like, the world's a shit show, so you might as well, like, be nice to yourself and not talk to yourself like a bully on the side, you know? So I do love that book.
There are a few that do deal in community care, which Jolenta and I like quite a bit. These are books mm-hmm. that are essentially saying, like, maybe you're depressed, not because you're saying the wrong mantras, but maybe you're depressed because the world is a shitstorm and we can do things to maybe make the world less of a shitstorm. Here are some things you can do to be, you know, a more active community member, to take better care of the environment, to take better care of people and changing the systems of oppression and so on. And Jolent and I tend to like those books a lot. They are few and far between in the self-help genre, by the way.
But there are more and more of them lately. So, like, yes. Keep them coming, people. Keep writing yes. about, like, how to infiltrate local government and such.
Yes, all of those. One book, an old classic called How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie, is very dated in some ways, but there are certain yeah. things in that book that I still think about. And the main one is be the dog when your loved one comes home from work. You know, be excited to see them. Don't just, like, start off complaining. You know, don't enter the room with complaints. Enter with the joy of a dog.
Maybe with a tennis ball in your mouth.
Yes, wagging that tail.
Yeah, I also tore apart all your socks today.
Out of love.
The idea of why not be like the dog? Be excited to see people. Enter with joy. Don't enter with a complaint first. And I think that's a really great way to treat each mm-hmm. other. And when I do it, I tend to be happier myself. And the people I'm greeting tend to be happier as well. So it works for everybody.
I was reading something the other day about when you smile, even when you don't mean it, it is sending a signal to your brain that then makes you feel like you mean it. And I thought, God, we are really just simple creatures in certain ways.
Yeah. We are like dogs.
We yes. are just like chemical reactions inside like an organic blob, aren't we?
How close do these books make self-improvement seem? Is the reader like one step away from whatever it is? Or do the books treat them like they're much further away than that? I know they're not all the same, but how tantalizing do the books make self-improvement seem?
I'll let Jolenta answer this because she actually is sometimes tantalized by self-help books.
I was going to say, I do get sucked in. And sometimes I have to say the ones about manifesting to me are the most tantalizing because they make such big promises. But then their advice is so vague. But they do get me intrigued. And they put in those studies that you've all heard about like talking positively to yourself when being treated for cancer, like had better outcomes than like not and stuff like that. And you're like, wait, I'm falling for it. They do a good job using like studies or sort of alluding to studies without really using them, without citing them properly, just using them to their benefit.
Who's funding those studies? Which journals are they in?
Right, yeah. But I do get sucked in a bit by the flashy promises, which always makes the actual theory behind the book more disappointing when you realize it's just another, like, manifest it book where I'm like, oh, I thought this one would actually help me, like, acquire wealth or, like, actually help me in the workplace. But it's just another, like, believe in yourself book.
Yeah, another kind of book that is, in my opinion, part of the self-help industry is the weight loss book. And a lot of self-help books that don't even claim to be about weight loss, that just claim to be about quote unquote living your best life.
Wellness.
Optimizing the self.
We'll still have multiple chapters on losing weight. We'll find it again and again in books. And we've only officially lived by one book that claims to be a weight loss book, which is French Women Don't Get Fat. But we keep coming across it again and again and again in other books. And I think that is so tantalizing, that promise for a lot of people in a world that rewards thinness, in a world that pays thin people more money and gives thin people the benefit of the doubt in so many situations, that it is tantalizing to be thin. And the idea that I can do it all in 2 weeks or 1 month and, you know, lose an obscene amount of weight that probably is not sustainable for anybody, you know, lose 30 pounds in 30 days, that kind of thing. Of course, that's tantalizing to people because that is a way to say I can escape sizeism. I can somehow equal the playing field and be treated with more kindness when the real problem is sizeism. It's not the size of your body that's the issue here. But that particular genre of self-help book never goes out of style. There are hundreds of new weight loss books every year. And Jolenta and I get pitched them all the time from publicists.
Does the pitch sort of change? Because I grew up in a very diet culture time where it was about deprivation. And like I've had a fat body ever since I was aware of having a body. So like I was very much in the firing line for those. And it was like, oh, your value doesn't matter because of your fat body. But it's all right because maybe it won't be disgusting if you just eat half a boiled egg a day. But I feel like in recent years, it's been a lot more about, I mean, about the same thing. But they'll be like, it's not a diet book. But then it is about restricted eating or calorie counting.
No. It's very much painted in the terms of optimization and health and not restriction, the way it was when I was coming up as a young woman with, you know, Weight Watchers, just straight up calorie counting, that sort of stuff. It's moved past like you don't have to count calories, like, but if you just like care about yourself and think about yourself the right way and like maybe try this exercise schedule I'm going to toss in, you know, for health reasons. It's all for health and like because you want to feel good inside of you, but like also within the societal constraints that say like thinness equals beauty, which the book doesn't say.
And moral betterness.
Right, right. Yeah, moral superiority, oh, yes. Like an ability to restrain oneself, quote unquote.
Don't be lazy. Don't be a glutton. All of those qualities of decency and goodness are imposed on that, too.
Are there any fact checkers for these books or any kind of body which is like, actually, this isn't a healthy lifestyle that they're preaching?
Well, that's partially why we started doing what we're doing.
It's you. You're the watchdog.
Kristen and I met working at a news program where you get pitched every book under the sun, including self-help books. I was the assistant at the show, working like three other jobs, desperate to get her life together. So I stole all the self-help books because no one was going to cover them for the news anyway. And then I started going through them, like started buying into like everyone. And then I was like, well, they can't all work. And also like, who is trying out all this shit? We're just have to like trust the author who like is a self-appointed expert in this. So I roped Kristen in to try this with me because she gets a little less carried away with promises, is a little less apt to join a cult because we wanted to see, like, is this actually something one could adhere to? One can actually apply all of these suggestions? And would one end up the way the author is or in a similar situation? And, like, usually not is the answer.
Yeah. As for the fact-checking question, one thing that we've come across again and again is every episode of Buy the Book, we provide a short bio of the author, a short biography, a short summary of the book, and then the actual steps as we see them. And it happens over and over and over again that as we're researching the biography of the author, we'll find out things like, oh yeah, they got sued for this at some point. They were charlatans. They graduated from a university that actually doesn't exist. It's just
the number of PhDs that aren't actual PhDs when you look into it. If you do one thing when you read a self-help book, just make sure you know where that PhD comes from at the end of the author's name, if there is one there. and just see, are they actually a doctor in something, or is it honorary doctorate? Is it from a mail away program that gives doctorates to everyone? Like, just look into it, because so many things go unchecked.
It's funny how trusting we are of the term doctor.
Totally.
You could just change your name legally to doctor and get around it that way.
Oh my gosh, you could. No accreditation needed.
Oh, Helen, you're so smart.
Wow, 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 wow. Wow.
Are there certain common factors that start to become evident over time, since you have absorbed quite a large sample now?
Well, we can quickly sort of parse out, like, what kind. There are a few different kinds. Like Kristen said, there's the diet. Then there's, like, we'll read a bit and be like, oh, this is self-optimization, not, like, community building. So there tend to be, like, a few main genres. And then of the self-optimization ones, you have to find, is it just people who think hard work is all you need, like prosperity gospel style? Or is it prosperity gospel plus, like, manifesting and, like, there's magic in the universe?
Yes.
Books love to swear in their titles now.
Oh, that's, yes.
Unfuck yourself.
The subtle art of not giving a fuck.
Yeah, they love swearing and they love being casual and cool. Like, girl, wash your face. Girl, unfuck yourself. Like, or, you know.
Bitch, do this thing.
Bitch, please. Like, queen, manifest that. They love, like, glomming onto popular vernacular, often like a hint late, so it'll feel like a bit clunky. Or you can tell, like, the popular vernacular has just been inserted everywhere into a work that, like, didn't originally have it. But yeah, we love swear words right now. Those are the cool, edgy self-help books. They get it. But it's just a lot of the same self-optimization manifesting.
Yeah, there's also a lot of books in the past few years that are kind of like, toughen up, Cookie. Stop being such a baby. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of books like that, too. And not just targeting men, by the way, targeting both men and women, saying, be stoic, don't be a baby, get your shit together.
Just like the ancient Greek Stoics used to put it.
Yes. I think I quoted that verbatim from one of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Wah, wah, boo, boo. That's what I said, right?
And a lot of books also push an unrelenting focus on forgiveness, where it's not in everybody's best interest to absolve those who have harmed them. And a lot of the self-help books can cause a lot of guilt and shame over the fact that people feel genuinely hurt and never received an apology from that rapist or from that abuser or from somebody who stole their money or whatever it is.
Even from, like, that systemic oppression. Like,
yes,
you know what I mean?
Yes. Maybe the relentless focus on forgiveness is actually going to make a person feel worse and not help them move on.
Yeah.
How are the writers writing about forgiveness?
A lot of them are saying that when you choose not to forgive, you're not punishing the person who did you wrong. You're punishing yourself with bitterness. You are now carrying the burden of whatever hurts you emotionally in a much larger way than what that actual transgression on its own was. And so they are urging us, most authors in the self-help world are urging us to let that burden go. And when you choose to forgive, you're letting that burden go. You're choosing not to live in the past anymore. And I don't see it that way. I'm not a very forgiving person. So, I'm okay with not forgiving. When I don't forgive, I don't necessarily feel that I'm living in the past. I'm just choosing not to absolve that person. I'm choosing not to say, oh, it's all right. It's totally fine that you did that thing.
You're choosing to have, like, learned actual lessons from that experience that you, like, can't unlearn. You know what I mean? Even if it's about, like, a certain person's character or, like, what you won't stand for, you know?
Yeah. And if you're somebody who loves forgiving and that's your jam, go for it. I'm not telling you to be like me. I'm just saying the way I am, I personally don't get a lot out of forgiveness when it comes to extreme situations. And I think that's okay that I don't want to forgive certain people. And it hasn't made my life worse. And Jolenta always says that I'm one of the happier people she knows. So
it's true.
It definitely hasn't turned me into an ugly, bitter person choosing not to forgive certain folks out there.
Yeah, well, also,
sometimes you have those feelings as a useful safeguard for yourself.
Exactly.
Not, you know, the same thing happening with them or similar people in future.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so I'm fine with it. Yeah. I'm not saying to go out there and like burn their house down at night while they're sleeping, but you know, maybe I don't need to just let it go either.
Yeah.
It's also weird how you are being held responsible for your own happiness, but they're not being held responsible for what they did in this equation.
Yeah, exactly.
Most of the things that self-help authors want us to forgive are transgressions that the perpetrator has never acknowledged or asked forgiveness for. If they don't see it as an issue, why should I forgive them? Yeah. Why should I forgive this person who has never once thought about what they did as a bad thing anyway?
This sort of intersects a little bit, I think, with like the concept of gratitude that seems to be a big one as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It's like, no, it sometimes makes you weaker. It's just you're still alive.
Yes. Oh, that's such a good way to put it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, you know, there's also in a lot of self-help books, this worldview of like, we should all be grateful for everything that happened to us because those things made us who we are. And it's like, oh, somebody who is paranoid and constantly walks in fear, should I be grateful for all of these things, really? I don't think we have to be grateful for everything bad that's happened to us.
I'm not saying this has happened to you by following these books, but there's a scenario in which you follow these books and what you end up with is like a sociopathic disregard for your own feelings and other people's. Whereas like all emotions are things to be overcome.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How British.
Yeah.
Along with that, a lot of these books are saying, you know, move past that feeling, but also stop worrying so much about what other people think, which on the one hand, I totally agree with that. I don't want to live imprisoned by constant concern of like, what are people going to say? What are people going to think about me if I do that? But to a certain extent, we do have to care about what other people think and say. Like, am I doing things that are frankly unkind? And some of the self-help books kind of are telling people to behave in ways that are not necessarily the kindest, that are teaching us to play games with our romantic partners or to take people for granted. And it's like, maybe I should be thinking about other people besides myself.
Well, if self-help leads to helping others, what happens to the term self-help? Has it eaten itself? Well, what a way to go. Kristen Meinzer and Jolenta Greenberg are the hosts of By the Book podcast, one of my favourite shows to listen to. Also always very relieved that I don't have to do what they do. Hear it in the pod places and at buythebookpod.com, and you can hear their new show, Romance Road Test, over on Audible. The Illusionist is an independent podcast, and the reason I can make this show by myself and how I want is thanks to you listeners for giving me your time and recommending the show to people, and for supporting it financially when you have the wherewithal at theillusionist.org/donate. For your contributions, you get behind-the-scenes info about the show and regular live streams with me and my dictionaries. During the most recent one, Ambrose was knitting socks, and I felt very proud of Ambrose when he finished them a few days later and shared pictures of them in the Illusiverse Discord, which is a community for you donors. So if you have spare funds, take yourself to theillusionist.org/donate and join us. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is spitchcock. Noun, an eel that has been split and grilled or fried. Verb, to spitchcock, prepare an eel or other fish this way. From the 15th century, whereas spatchcock is probably from the 18th century, and maybe unrelated, they don't know. Anyway, try using spitchcock in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. Thanks to Martin Austwick for the music. You can hear his compositions via palebirdmusic.com and as Palebird on Bandcamp. Our ad partner is Multitude. To sponsor an episode of the show in 2023, contact them at multitude.production/ads. Find me at Illusionist Show on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And find every episode of the podcast in audio and transcript format and the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words and links to the guests, plus more information about the episode topics, at the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.